This is tape number three, side number one of the interview with William Lucas. It's taking place on July 12th, 1994 at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming. My name is Mary Tippett Andes, and when we finished the last time we talked, we had talked a little bit about superstitions and finished talking about the Selwood Mine. So I guess what I'd like to pick up is, you mentioned there were other superstitions that miners had, or that there were some superstitions that they had besides the belief in the ghost of Murphy. Can you tell me what some of those superstitions were?
We'll make one correction on that. Instead of Murphy, the name was Jeffrey. Jeffrey. That's the one, is it? Jeffrey was supposed to have disappeared before 1900. In the upper levels of the Cliff Shack mine. That was the rumor. And then this Italian fellow happened to be working up in there. That was beginning to bother him. And when he saw Jeffries, he just went berserk. He threatened to jump down the hole. The boss happened to walk in there and caught him, you know, and he said, if I see him coming around again, I said, I'm going to jump down that hole. Boss said, no, you can't do that. He said, I don't want to see you get hurt. So he told him, he said, you better come with me. He come down the lower level where I was working at. He said, Millie, he said, you take care of him, you know. And I did, for a couple of weeks there, you know. But he never did go back up there. Now, who knows? I said that it could have been in the say around 1880 or something like that. He could have disappeared up in there. Maybe he was covered up with some fallen ground or stuff like that. And anything could have happened then. There was nothing safety in them days, you know. It isn't like it is now, that you're checked every hour, you know, and find out if you're still around. So, as far as any other superstitions, I don't know of any others, but that existed. That's about the only one that's I can think of.
Was there ever any talk about women in the mine underground?
Yeah, they did.
I mean, women as workers. What would they have thought of a woman working underground?
Well, they did at that time. They didn't, as far as women working underground. I never did hear of any word mentioned about women work in the mine. Although they had worked at the open pit mine in Negaunee and the old Jackson mine. They were working on surface, you know, cleaning out. I don't know what they were doing, but there's pictures at the old Jackson mine there, women helping out. But I don't know of any had ever working underground.
Okay, let's, do you remember, you've mentioned a couple of nicknames for guys or for the kinds of jobs that they did. Can you think of any other nicknames?
Well, there's not too many. Lots of them were usually called by their last name, you know. There was Gossoon, and they had some... What the heck were they? Mudbox and Skinner, Skinny, and I can't think of any right now, but Old Beaver, Little Beaver, and I can't think of any right now.
Okay. One last thing I wanted to pick up from what we talked about before was any recollections that you have about the strike of 1946?
Yeah. That was a long one. That was costly. But if you had a few hundred dollars saved away, you just had to use up that, you know. And then those, from what I heard afterward, that the officials, they were getting money from the union, you know, the union officials, and they, but we never got a penny. Not one penny. And when you're off for 6-7 months, you know, that hurts. But we rolled through it anyway. By the time we started back to work, we start all over again.
Sure.
And just lucky to be back to work. And there was, tempers were short. Father against son and stuff like that. Some of them are, they still haven't been forgiven, you know. Yeah. And a lot of old guys, they were charging up their groceries and that, and then then when they got back to work, they, when their money start coming in, they start trading with somebody else. I know one character fighting in location even, not far from me. He charged up a huge bill over at Cullitz's store. And when he got back to work, he quit going to Cullitz's. And he says that Cullitz's said pretty good. I fed him right through the strike, and he said when he gets back to work, he don't come around anymore. You know, that's an awful thing to do. There's quite a few of them, and that hurts.
Mm-hmm. How difficult was it to save money before the strike and after the strike? How difficult was it to save money?
Well, it was. You just had to make up your mind that every paycheck you got, you just took some off the top and say, this is going aside, and the rest will just divvy up what we're going to need now till next payday. We didn't get paid every 2 weeks always, you know. So then, but we got back on our feet. Yeah. And to work harder, harder you work, the more money you got. Yeah. And
I want to ask you about Cullitz's store too. Cullitz's, can you tell me a little bit about that store, where it was, because it doesn't exist anymore, and how well you knew the storekeeper and things like that, and how much business you might have done there or anything like that?
Storekeeper was right here in West Ishmael, Cullitz's store.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a young couple, and he was married to one local girl here, type of a girl, and he was good. He carried a lot of those, the miners, you know, on there. And we didn't charge up there because we had the cash out to pay for our grub. And then we were living out the camp, so that helped a lot. And we had all we wanted to eat, we were eating good. So, but I know the storekeepers, they were left. Yeah. And that was the only one around here. I don't know, I think in town is, some of the stores were given credit, a lot of credit, you know. Yeah. So.
Okay. All right. Where we left off then, also on the last tape, was at the point when you were working underground in the cliff shaft.
Yeah.
And you had decided that you didn't want to test other people's new equipment anymore. You wanted to get more than company count. Can you remember about when that was, and then did you go back into mining after that, or what?
Oh, yeah, I stayed mining. But I took, finally, the all these engineers that were with their company and advertising their machines, they were satisfied. They spent their time what was allotted for them, some 2 weeks and like that. They finally gave, you know, went their ways. And then the results that they got, they turned it into the company then, and to show how much, because they had to keep an accurate count of every foot of ground that they drilled in and how long it took them to drill it and all the other problems they had. And then they asked me even one time, what's the best machine built? Well, just out of plain sight, I said, well, if I had my choice, I'll take that Chicago Pneumatic. Why is it you want the Chicago Pneumatic? I said, because it's lighter, and he said, it drilled just as good as the Ingersoll there. Ingersoll was about 10 pounds, 15 pounds heavier and more bulkier. And this is more smaller and compact. And you come with a good jack leg that you put the machine on top for a leg, you know. It's like a road runner. That's what it was, you know. And well, anyway, I didn't hear any more about it. And then as time went on, there was a new Chicago Pneumatic come, yeah. But they also bought some of the others too. They not only bought a Chicago Pneumatic, they bought the Ingersoll Ram. And they still didn't want to give up their old customers that they carried, you know, in the old days, you know, that because the other companies were coming out with new type of machines also. So they got, there's about four or five different machines. No, I counted six one time. There was Joy, what's his name now? What would I say now? Did you know Captain Tom Tippett?
I knew of him.
Did you know his boys? Roy?
Roy and Doug?
Yeah, Doug.
Yeah.
And there was another one.
Ooh, I don't know the other one.
I think there was three again.
Wilfred?
I knew Wilfred. I worked for Wilfred at Matherby. And what was one? There was a, we used to call Two Shot. That was the youngest boy. Yeah, he was a Two Shot. He was a salesman for Joy Manufacturing Company. He was selling Joy machines also, you know. But I never had anything to do with him as far as machines was concerned. Yeah, there was Wilfred and Dougie. They were nice guys. Yeah. And I worked for Wilfred at when I first went to Mother B. And I was walking around in there one day. And I was in a place close to where I worked, my regular place, you know. I had to get something. And I went through one crosscut. And I was looking up in the old workings up there. And I was wondering, you seen a light coming? And it happened to be Captain Tippett, you know. And he says, asked me, he said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm just going through. Oh, he said, you better not hang around here. She said, geez, he said, we both looked up an old slope up there, and he said, it looks pretty bad up there. We better get out of here. It was already abandoned, you know. And he said, that level will come down anytime. So, what do you call it? We left from there then, you know. But I saw him quite a few times after that, but mine is big, you know. Mm-hmm. And he never did come around where I was working then at the end, you know. But
I want to backtrack a little bit. Can you tell me about how long you stayed mining at Cliff's Shaft before you moved to Matherby, and then what year was Matherby?
I stayed mining at Cliff's Shaft till, let's see, 73 is when I retired, 74. That's 4 or 5. I think it was around 1968. I was mining right up to the last. And as soon as I went to Matherby, I continued mining. But it's a different type of mining. Okay. Entirely different.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What were the big differences that you noticed between Cliff Shaft and Matherby?
Well, Cliff Shaft is wide open. Stopes. Stope is one big hollow. Like you've seen pictures of the Carlsbad Caverns. That's the way it is, you know. And you see the different workings at different elevations. That's what I mean by laterals. And everything was not on, it isn't all on level ground. There's workings up higher. And in order to reach those places, they had to have ladders to get up there. And that's what they call laterals, and you know. And then they'd splice sometimes 2 or 3 ladders to get higher up. Zigzag, you know. So I was mining all the time, all my life I've mined. Every type of mine you can think of. Shaft. That new shaft in town. I went down with that. We went about 1,800 feet, something like that, down. And when I was at Lloyd, I worked on weekends in the shaft, repairing shaft. And then I was mining during the week. But then on Sunday, Saturday nights, and I'd get overtime. And I got in trouble even out there at North Lake. There was, we were working 5 days a week. And Captain Tippett told me, he said, Billy, you want to work on the shaft over the weekend? I said, sure. He said, okay, you come out so-and-so in the morning. Well, that was good. I was getting an extra time and a half. And that kept up for 3-4 months. Then all of a sudden, we went down to 4 days a week. Then those Italian guys in North Lake, they start complaining. They said, how come you got that young Billy? They call me Young Billy. How come you got Young Billy working? He's a single man. He says, me married man, we got a dozen kids. I need the money. Yeah. Well, he said, why didn't you turn it down when you was offered? But you were satisfied with 5. And some of them had gone even to the Cap's house and told him, he said, that you want that work. So Cap called me in and he said, well, Will, he said, this is the race in hell because you're working, you're single and getting an extra shift. I said, that's okay, let them have it. So they got their, you know, extra shift. But I didn't mind it anyway. Sure, I was satisfied. Because I had been out of work. I went right through a depression, you know. So I tickled pink to get all the money I could get. And that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it very common for guys to turn down extra shifts if it was offered to them?
What?
Was it very common for guys to turn down extra shifts if they had a chance?
Mm-hmm. Lots of them. They figure they're making good money. Fridays, well, they give them a weekend of raise hell. And but then when they got cut on the short, that's when it hurt.
You said that you worked about 5 years at the Mather B, and that it was quite different from Cliff's shaft.
Yeah.
You talked about Cliff's being very large, and the ore was a lot harder too, was it not? Mm-hmm. What other differences do you remember about the two mines?
Well, it's one thing was ventilation. It was good at Cliff Shaft. It was so huge, and the constant draft, you know. Then you had the two shafts, A shaft and B shaft. The air circulated right through all the time. You couldn't stand in one place, and you know, too long. Otherwise, you'd get cold, you know. You had to wear, like wearing clothes for mining. You had to have heavy underwear, heavy pair of pants, then your work pants on top, or overall. And then with a heavy undershirt, and a flannel shirt, or wool shirt, and a jacket on top. In Mather B, you could have, in some of the places, all you needed was a pair of pants and a shirt, and cut off sleeves right up to the elbow. Mm-hmm. Sure, it was day and night difference, and it was, Mather B is hot, some of the places. And I'll tell you this, smoky. Oh, I see smoke. They would be blasting all day long. Day long, you know, the tremor that would, barring down chutes, they'd have to blast, you know. The smoke would go through.
Was it a different color in Cliff Shaft than it was?
At Cliff Shaft, it was more bluish, you know. And it's red at Mather B.
Was there a difference in the way that the ore stuck to your clothing at Cliff's than there was at Mather B?
Oh, yes, it was like at Cliff's there, it slid off quite a bit, you know. It's a sharper particles, shiny, real shiny stuff. And but not at Mother B, it was just... It's just like tomato juice, you know, it's stuck right on you. Sure, it is. That was something.
You told me that you had helped to sink the newest shaft at Cliff Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
What year was that, and can you describe that a little bit for me?
That was in 61. Yeah, I went down between the two shafts. They put down another shaft. They started right from the surface. I didn't get in on the right at the beginning, the first 2 weeks, until they got through the solar, you know. Until they got to the solid ground, you know. They had to get down about 30 feet to all the gravel and stuff, blue stuff. But from there down, then it was solid rock. Then they had to drill the whole thing out and blast. And then, handle the dirt and pull it up. And that was a nice shop put in. We worked on three shifts, and it's a shame that they had to stop, because that shaft was the most modern shaft. And you know, the hoist for that shaft is the most modern in the country. It's automatic, and you don't need a cage rider to escort, you know, when you go in, or when you go, just like in the hospital, you go there and you see if there's a dial there, and if it's marked on there, if it's available, the light is on, you know, but it tells you where the cage is at the moment, and if you call for it, then he'll come and you ring what level you want it on. Everything was button control and quiet, just like an hospital, sure. And it held, I think it was 50 men or 60 on each deck. So it was pretty near about 90 to 100 men at a time. And that was something. And too bad they had to leave everything down there. But the hoist is still up there. And they said that eventually, the way we were told, that when they ever opened up the Cascade mine in Palmer, that's an area east of Palmer in there that Cliffs owns, and that is ready for mining, but they said they will use that hoist there. And but it's idling up there, I guess just collecting dust. Yeah. Then that same hoist, they put on bigger skips on there, you know, that pulls up. They could load more ore in the two skips than before. And they didn't use it not too many years, and then all of a sudden the word came that the mine is closing. It caught a lot of the guys by surprise, you know. But they said they got in a hurry to try and pelletize that ore, but they did not find a method. They tried their best. Probably if they tried it now, they would, because it's similar to the ore that they have at Republic. That is hard ore, and they're able to pelletize that. But now they could use cliff shaft ore, just like they figure on Republic, making briquettes instead of small pellets, and that, you know, that would work good. But you ask any of the old time miners, even there, they never did play out the cliff shaft. There's a lot of ore left, sure. But what Cleveland says, got to go. They were already, they had Tillman going, and Empire, and Republic. Deep mines were a thing of the past. See, that's the way it goes. They shut her down and let her fill up with water and leave everything behind. There's millions and millions of tons of iron, scrap iron left down there now. Sorry. Motors, puffers, pumps, transformers, rails, trolley wire. There's 60 miles of railroad track under there. Sure.
This is take number 3, side number 2 of the interview with Bill Lucas, and this is taking place on July 12, 1994 at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes. I guess the last thing we want to talk about is during the 5 years that you worked at Mather B, was there anything in particular that stands out in your mind about the Mather B? And just tell me about that if there is anything.
Well, one thing about Mather B, you can say that it was smoky. The day didn't go by that you didn't get smoke from somebody's, you know. And some of the places were, there were mud. You'd walk in there. And the transfers and the ropes, oh, you had to be continuously on the lookout for low places. And like when they're scraping even, oh, gee, some of the scrapers and tuggers were in such places that you couldn't get in there hardly to operate, and you were bent over like this, operating the machine, 200 feet out, you know, and the place is coming down, you know, caving. And, of course, that's the way the scrapermen had to work, you know, but us miners, we didn't come under that, but, and the hurry up, you know, oh, you had to be very careful when you're walking on a level even. The motors would come around full speed, you know. You just had to find a good safety place to back into, and they would vibe, zoom. There's quite a few who got killed that way. They come down the ladder road and stepped right in the track, and there the motor come right through and they ran them over, you know.
How would the men know if a motor was coming? Was it noisy or anything like that?
Noise. There was one that was a boss, Bart Judas even. And Bart was, he came down the ladder road and he stepped on the track. And the whistle was blowing, you know, or the siren. Usually when the motor leaves from inside, they pull the switch so that alerts everybody down the line. And he was halfway down the line on the curve, and the lights were flashing, and the noise was on, you know. Well, he didn't see anybody. That's when he met his snake. He should not have gone. As soon as he stepped out, the motor come behind. Sure, they didn't have time to, you know, watch. They were just ran robo. He should have stayed right back on a ladder. Wait till that motor goes. Because he knew that the motor's coming. Because the lights were flashing. And they make a noise when they're flashing, you know. And, what do you call it? That was a sad case there.
Did that happen on one of the shifts that you were working?
On the same shift, but on a different level, you know. Yeah. We didn't hear about it until later on in the day, didn't you? Through the intercom, you know. One thing good about Mather B, they had a good intercom system there. Every mining contract had an intercom system there, hooked up. And if you ever needed anything, all you had to do was get on the intercom and call the dispatcher. Your dad was on, you'd get your dad right away. And you relate what the problem is, you know. Like the motorman, anytime they moved, well, they'd have to call your dad. And then he'd call back and say, okay, the coast is clear now. And if it wasn't clear, he'd hold them back, you know. Because he had
everything on a chart there, and you know just where they all were at each minute. Yeah, that was a hard job on the nerves there. Keep track of all them motors, you know. And then not only the motor, there were other repair crews in there, and then they had to be watching each other, you know. And there was some, there was a lot of close calls. Some of them timber haulers, when they'd come through on them curves, even you could hear the bell on them. You could hear that bell on their motor ringing. You couldn't see them. So much smoke, you know, until they whizzed the one right by, you know. And, geez, I'll tell you.
The smoke you're talking about was the, was that from the blasting?
Yeah, blasting, yeah. They would blast any time when they want. The soap miners, you know, the scrapermen. They had to pull the dirt up, and if it just hung up in the chute, they put a charge of powder up in there, blast it down, then come down, and okay for a while, and scrape. And that's the way it was. Smoke, smoke, smoke.
What did it smell like down there?
Real acrid. You could almost taste it. So thick at times, you know. Some of them, a lot of times, it's so thick, you had to get down on your knees to find out where the track is, you know, when you're walking, you know, and that. Oh, that smoke, that was the worst part of it.
So that was pretty common, that all the areas were filled with smoke down there?
Yeah, well, they cleared out, but then it takes so long for it to clear, because they're continuously making those smoke. See? If they would stop even for 1 hour even, they would clear out. But there's always somebody blasting. Yeah. And that's what I didn't like about it, you know.
It sounds like you really had a strong preference for Cliff Shaft instead of Mather B. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I wish that Cliff Shaft would have kept going. I probably would have worked another 3 years more. Seems longer years, you know. Cliff Shaft was nice and close to home. And we were on one shift only. Everything that you've done today, you got it facing tomorrow morning. See, you know just what you're going to do. You know just what you need, and you plan for it. And most of the time, the miner was the boss in the contract, you know. He done what needed to be done. And he had to make the right decisions and that, you know. And you had to make your place safe, because it was your neck. You had to make sure you looked up, see any cracks up there or anything. See it loose. Take it down. Sure. And if you didn't get it down today, you got it down tomorrow. Sure. Yeah. And some of them chunks were big too, you know, that were up there. You test them with a bar, and they sound solid, but some of them chunks are so big, you know, that even a crack in there, they sound, you know, they fool you. You just have to, you know, be careful. And then lots of them we blasted down, you know, use powder and get them down. But I never had any come down on my head anyway. All the while, I made sure that.
So then, when all was said and done, you retired in 1973, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. You know, it was October 15th. And I figured, well, that's when I'm going to call it quits.
So how many years did you work in the mines altogether?
Altogether, about 37 and a half years, yeah.
Let's go back now to the very beginning and talk about growing up. We've already talked about the date that you were born and your parents' names. Did I ask you about your brothers and sisters' names and the year they were born?
No, I had... there was Ida. She was the oldest sister. There's Lila. And Jenny. And Lillian. And Limp. And I'm the only boy. Yeah.
Are you the youngest also?
Pardon?
Are you the youngest?
Yeah.
You're the youngest child?
I'm not the youngest. Lempy was. She was the youngest one. Yeah, I'm in between Jenny and Lila. The only one that's living is Lila and Limpy. And Lila's in California and Limpy's in Rapid River. Yeah.
You were born in Ishpeming, is that correct? Where were you born?
Oh, North Lake.
Okay. What things do you remember about growing up in North Lake?
Well, I can't remember too much because I was so young. I couldn't have been very maybe a couple of months old. Like, that is a blank. Yeah. Then we moved to West Ishpeming, and right across from Bengry's house, there's that double two-story house.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in that, I think, the first winter. And then my dad bought this old one right next to us here shortly after that. And, but as far back as I remember, the closest I can think back is when I was, when we marched to West Ishpeming School from the old school in 1916. And it's marked right there on that, I don't know if you see it, no. It's on top of the school. 1916 when they completed that school.
Mm-hmm.
It is winter time, and we couldn't have been no more than about 5 years old, I think, at that time. 4 years old. Yeah.
Where was the old school?
Pardon?
Where was the old school?
Right on the corner of what's that center street there? Right at the intersection there. There's a new house there now. Right next to where the old store used to be.
Oh, so that would be maybe Center Street and Silver Street?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you were in kindergarten when that new school
opened? I think so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's when I went. We started in, I can always remember, we went to a side door. And that was our homestead then. For all the years I went to 8th grade, all the way, it was, I went from 4th grade up to 6th grade. I skipped 5th grade.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why?
That's the way it was. They said, you deserve to be in 6th grade. Yeah, I didn't have to go 5th. Yeah.
So then how long did you stay in school through high school, or did you...
I went to high school 2 years. And that was in around springtime. I took sick. And I was in sick for a whole couple of months, more than that even. And then my uncle came up from Chicago for his annual vacation here, you know. And he talked me into coming to Chicago with him. So I went. That ended my schooling right there. Yeah, and I was sorry afterwards, I never did finish. Mm-hmm. But that's how it was cut short.
So you said that you worked in the telephone factory in Chicago, is that right?
I worked for Western Electric. If you made telephones, all your handset mountings, you know, that they made. And I worked there for 3 years. And man, I would have worked longer even, but they cut down. The depression was coming on, and it was really hurting. They cut it down to 2 days a week. And I felt sorry for them. A lot of them guys, they were married, you know. And even I was, you know, concerned because, heck, I wasn't making enough to pay for my room and board. So then I come home. Yeah.
Now, you said you were already working at the Lloyd mine when you were single. When did you meet Corrine, and how did you meet?
Out north. Yeah. I saw her a few times out there. And I used to see her out there picking berries, and she'd come around to the camps and that, and met her at Emo's a couple of times. I got acquainted with her. So that's the way it went. Yeah.
Now, the camp that you have, was that your parents' camp?
Yeah.
Is that? Okay. And just for this, for the record, that's on the Little Dead River, right? So it's out in that vicinity. Okay. Now, you met out north. Can you tell me what you did? Did you ever have a date, or did you pretty much see each other when you were out picking blueberries and things like that? What did you do for courtship?
No, we didn't go on any dates. We went up to hunt. Took in the shows and like that. Mm-hmm. And the town on business. And winter was coming on too, you know, so kind of hurried things up. Yeah. And we went on a lot of hikes, you know. A lot of hikes. And went fishing. Done a lot of fishing out there. And roamed around. Scaled all them big mountains up there. Yeah. Carved our initials on a lot of trees. They probably still there. Yeah. Yeah.
Just for the record, give me your wife's maiden name.
Her maiden name? Mm-hmm. Was Corrine Courtney.
How long after you met did you get married, and what's the date of your marriage?
It was 46. It was about a year after, I think.
You got married in 1946, or you met
46, yeah.
Do you happen to recall when you would go to a movie, what a movie ticket would have cost?
At that time?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're around, I don't think they were not even about 40 cents, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And how many children do you have?
We've got, right now, there's Pat and Paul and Eric and Carolyn.
Okay.
Four.
While the kids were growing up, what kinds of things would you do as a family?
Well, we went on trips, not long ones. We spent a lot of time at the camp. Yeah. Went on a lot of berry picking. That's one thing we done when we were small too. We done a lot of berry picking. Mm-hmm. And that helped, like during the Depression. We'd my dad would, he had a hunting camp about Flat Rock, and he'd load the kids in the car and bring us out there for a week and leave us there. And we picked berries all day long. My sisters and I, we picked many bushels a day. And he would come on the weekends and bring empties and take the full ones in. And we made more money than he did in the mine. Imagine. On blueberry. Sure. Man. Every morning when we leave the camp, each kid had a 12-quart pail. And we had that full by 11 o'clock. And in the afternoon, we'd pick up another 12-quart pail. Well, imagine five kids. I imagine the berries. And we didn't have to go far, just like here across the street. It was just grapes, you know. There was berries all over. And you just get tired of picking one place. You just move over here and just kill the monotony, you know. Yeah, and but we hadn't enjoyed ourselves out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd always be home in time for, well, by 5 o'clock, have supper. We had, well, them days, there was no radios or anything, you know. We'd go to bed early and have bonfire and whatnot, you know, but that was this. I'd listen to the coyotes and hear the owls, and there were more days.
What about the time when your own kids were growing up? Was camp pretty much where you would spend vacations, or did you take trips or anything like that?
No, we didn't go too far. We spent a lot of our time at camp. Yeah. It seemed like the car just went there all the time. Yeah. We did go to Escanaba and places like that, and Copper Country, Porcupines, and our Norway, within 200 mile radius. About it, you know.
Was it very hard during the time that the kids were growing up to make ends meet? Were there things that you did that would help to stretch your money at that time?
Yes, it was. There was a lot of little expenses kept coming. That if you had a few dollars saved up, well, you're figuring on get something, but something would pop up. Well, you had that little, what do you call, cookie jar. You tapped that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like we always made it, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know. There was expenses, hospitalization and stuff like that, and injuries, and not major, you know, but to it.
Mm-hmm. I think there was one thing that was unique in how shall I say this, because it's part of my history too, out north and growing vegetables out north, and can you tell me about that, how all the families, all the the families connected to the Corpies grew vegetables and stored them in the basement out north.
Oh, you mean the miners?
No. Grandpa Corpy's field with the potatoes and the carrots and all
that. Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
One thing, they're getting down. Excuse me, I'm going to have a drink of water.
After a break for a drink of water, we're going to continue and talk about growing vegetables.
Yeah, Grandpa had wonderful gardens out there. And he raised a lot of potatoes, turnips, beets, and wonderful strawberry. And boy, he was getting a lot of vegetables. And we'd go up there, him, pray the digging time, and everybody would help. And scattered them up and in a hurry sometime, and get them in before it rained. And same thing with the turnips. And there was one thing that and if they had lots to eat, there's more than enough. Mm-hmm. And he sold a lot of potatoes and rutabagas and turnips, and he sold a lot of strawberries. And I'm surprised that, you know, none of the boys have kept up the strawberry patch out there. Mm-hmm. And he had a good spot there and great big strawberries. Mm-hmm. And one thing you got to hand it to old Grandpa Corpy, during the Depression, he did not go hungry. He had everything there at home. And all the vegetables and potatoes and the meat, he had chickens, and he sold creamery, milk to the dairy farm. You know. That was a grandma's end of the, you know, selling the milk. And on weekends, he would load up the wagon, the truck, and would take in a load of hardwood, firewood, to the customers in town. He'd collect $20, and that was nice income. Compared to the people that were living in town, they were on welfare. They didn't have a thing, and they were destitute. But all those farmers that lived out, you know, outside in the rural areas, they went through a depression good, because they had the foresight to see and to plan for their survival. And there was enough to eat, that was the main thing. And always a cash coming in on wood. And he got one merchant, one dry goods merchant in town, he said, the only cash I see, he said, coming into the store on Saturdays, when Matt Corpy comes in, and he said, there's a $20 bill right there. Yeah, imagine. You couldn't, that guy downtown, they're just walking around in their Sunday suits and off welfare, you know.